All the latest business news from WA, delivered daily. At close of business, news briefing.
Good afternoon, it's Jacinta Burton with your Tuesday afternoon headlines. A mystery proposal has emerged to demolish a 123-year-old building in West Perth, which the Heritage Council claims does not warrant protection. The City of Perth received an application to demolish the Desborough and Terrace houses on Hay Street at the intersection of Havelock Street last week. The site currently contains a two-storey building which was built back in 1903. The application is requesting a complete demolition and removal of the two-storey home and building and rear car park, retaining walls, old septic tanks and soak wells, as well as trees, stumps and vegetation. But it's not yet clear who is spearheading the proposal. The places are not on the State Heritage List, with the Heritage Council declaring in 2017 that the places did not warrant assessment. According to CoreLogic and ASIC, the site is owned by the Healy family of Gooseberry Hill. According to CoreLogic, the property was last sold for $1.17 million back in 2002. More than 1,600 submissions have been lodged against Adrian Finney-Smith's beach project, with 852 in support, according to public consultation figures released today. Figures from the Department of Planning, Lands and Heritage released today show that 63% of public submissions are opposed to the proposed village resort, while 33.3% were in favour. A further 3% were in support of the proposal, subject to modifications. The $280 million proposal was submitted to the WA Planning Commission's State Development Assessment Unit, established during COVID to assess developments of public significance. The project involves a 65-room hotel, 61 holiday homes, a camping area with 36 raised platforms for tents, a wellness centre, surf club and a general store. Opponents of the plan have criticised its bushfire preparedness, sewerage capabilities and its use of state planning authorities over local bodies. A Smith's Beach project spokesperson said the recent public consultation process had demonstrated considerable community support for the proposal. The proposal also attracted significant interest while with the Environmental Regulation Authority, with 2,260 submissions calling for a public environmental review, the highest level of review undertaken by the EPA. And finally, almost one-third of West Australians think inflation won't ease for at least 2 years, but they're still more confident than they were 5 years ago. Consumers are less confident in the September quarter than they have been in the 3 months to June, according to the Chamber of Commerce and Industry of WA. But confidence is still higher than that of much of the past decade and about 11% stronger than 5 years ago. Good employment prospects and the state government's performance both contributed positively to consumer sentiment. Rising interest rates and high inflation were negatives. About 51% of consumers believed inflation pressure would ease within the next 2 years, while 30% expected prices to continue to rise. In Perth, inflation hit 7.4% in the year to June. Chamber Chief Economist Aaron Morey said consumers were becoming more circumspect in spending and choice of brands. He said West Australians had strongly backed cuts to payroll tax, with about 65% saying it was unfair to local businesses to face a higher burden than other states. And coming up next, journalist Matt McKenzie and I discuss force majeure clauses and how COVID may change the way that risk is distributed in the future.
We understand that business relies on being informed. That's why Business News is your most reliable source of news, industry insights and business connections. To stay fully informed, we encourage you to subscribe to our emails, flick through our magazine and visit businessnews.com.au for daily news updates. It's the best way to ensure you have the information you need to be future ready. Business News. More news, more insights, more connections.
Welcome back to At Close of Business. I'm Matt McKenzie and I'm joined by Business News court reporter extraordinaire Jacinta Burton. Jacinta, how are you?
I'm well, Matthew. How are you?
Excited to be here, Jacinta. You and I were following something recently, the battle for control of Griffin Coal, a big energy story that ended up in court, and that sparked what I thought was a fascinating piece in our recent magazine about force majeure. And it's not the only example of where force majeure has been relevant in a contract in recent times. But can you just start us off by telling us, what does force majeure actually mean? I expect that's probably French, is it?
It certainly is a French term, and it directly translates to greater force. It's essentially used to safeguard businesses from liability where there is an act of God, a natural disaster, a man-made catastrophe that's essentially prevented it from fulfilling its contractual obligations. It's not technically a general legal principle, but it's often included in contracts as sort of a get-out-of-jail-free card, if you will. And obviously, we've just had a once-in-a-century pandemic, and the government halted travel across land, air and sea, and global supply chains were strained for more than a year. And so what we've seen coming out of that is a wave of these actions that really hinge on the COVID-19 pandemic, those border closures and the recent labour shortages that we've seen as well, meeting the definition of a force majeure event.
Yeah, I can imagine there's plenty of contracts that get signed around this city that include a clause on force majeure, and people probably think, well, we'll never need that, or maybe we'll just keep that in there just in case. And I bet they never expected to then find the state's borders were closed. No travel, no workers allowed in or out for, you know, a couple of years almost. We spoke a little bit about Griffin. That's a fascinating example. Can you just take us through the background there?
Yeah, of course. So as you know, Matthew, you and I covered this together. Griffin tried to stop power generator Blue Waters from installing a controller over a 400,000-tonne coal supply shortfall. And now Griffin claimed the deficiency was a direct byproduct of the ongoing industrial dispute and a worker shortage. And they declared an event of force majeure earlier this year. In a writ that we obtained from the Supreme Court, Griffin argued that its ability to deliver under the contract and replenish the stockpile as well had been hamstrung by the state government's border closures, the pause in migration, and of course the COVID isolation requirements for staff. And obviously Blue Waters rejected this claim. That court matter, unfortunately, was very short-lived, with Deloitte's appointment rendering Griffin's plea essentially redundant.
Yeah, the interesting thing about this is, of course, that the company ended up having someone appointed to it anyway.
That's right.
So the injunction may have delayed the inevitable, or potentially it even allowed other parties to manoeuvre around, because in the end it was the syndicated group of senior creditors that made the appointment rather than Blue Waters. Now, I have heard down there that the coal is starting to be mined again. It's being produced, and that's very useful. If you want to run a coal-fired power station, you need coal. But the interesting thing about this is we say it's a force majeure thing, but of course there has been long debate about Griffin Coal, about the operations down there, about the overburden in the mine, about the cost of the mine. So it's a very difficult circumstance for them. Acciona, that was one we looked at earlier this year in terms of the Avertus Energy Project in Kwinana.
Yeah, and that was the other example I used in this story, because the foundation of Griffin's case was quite similar to this one. Now, Acciona tried to exit its engineering and construction contract with Macquarie for the $700 million Kwinana Waste-to-Energy Project. And in that case, they basically argued that the state's border rules and the pandemic basically constituted like a blockade or an embargo for its workforce and amounted to a force majeure event under the contract. And they relied on parts of the state government's own legislation as evidence in that particular case to prove that it affected the passage of workers into WA. We're still awaiting the outcome. There was a trial in June and the Supreme Court's yet to make a decision.
Yeah, the interesting one there is that Acciona, I think, was also working on the Bunbury Outer Ring Road.
Yes, yeah.
And the East Rockingham Waste to Energy project. And, you know, it's interesting that there was a force majeure used in one contract, but not the other two. Now, you've spoken to a legal mind about where all this is going.
That's right. So we sat down with Cause Chambers Westgarth partner Nicholas Ellery, who had some fascinating insight into what's happening behind the scenes. And we were trying to get some data on just how prevalent this has become in the wake of the pandemic. And he confirmed what we suspected, and that's that there's certainly been an increase in the number of cases, but there's no real data around it, because most of these cases are dealt with by way of a confidential dispute resolution process rather than in the open court. So we never actually get to see them. The big thing for force majeure is exactly how the contract clause is worded. So the wording differs from contract to contract, and historically, as you highlighted earlier, a lot of people would not have considered the sort of logistical challenges that COVID presented. And many of the clauses also stipulate that the contractor is obliged to take steps to mitigate any impact or any loss. The second thing is that it doesn't really protect people in the cases of a shift in the economy that might either affect the profitability of that contract or the time within which it can be delivered. The general trend as well is that risk is allocated to the contractor over the principal, and that's particularly problematic when contractors are already operating on tight margins, as you've covered a great deal, Matt. So all of these things together can make it really difficult to actually pursue this legal action on the basis of force majeure. And yeah, there are just a lot of hoops, it seems, you have to jump through.
Yeah, one example there that I think is quite prevalent with regard to Griffin, and I believe this was brought up in court, but regardless, it's a question worth asking, is, you know, Griffin, if Griffin has to supply the coal, would they could import it.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, then you have government regulation over that. Yeah. There have been government restrictions. It's also not profitable. But I recall the conversation was, well, it doesn't matter if it's profitable to import the coal. What matters is that's an action that they could take to ensure that the coal is getting out to the customer. And so that kind of makes it also additionally complicated, isn't it? Because that's mm-hmm. one of the examples of something a contractor or a business could do to try to
mitigate. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Now, just more broadly, you've said there's a lot of disputes at the moment under force majeure. What about this? Do you think the way that contracts are being drafted now is changing? Mm-hmm. Is it different?
Yes, absolutely. At least that's what Mr. Ellery has told us. The advice that we have is that the pandemic has totally shifted the way in which these contracts are being formulated and handled by the business community. Potential ripple effects of a catastrophic event or a pandemic, and the way in which that risk is allocated has become a real key consideration. The other thing that Mr. Ellery highlighted that I thought was really interesting as well is that many businesses didn't realise just how much power the government had in terms of shutting down parts of the economy, closing borders, stopping trade. That really surprised the business community. And so now that's being factored into formulating these clauses and making sure they're broad enough to handle any potential ripple effects that come in the future.
Well, major projects are a major part of the state's economy, and so no doubt this analysis will be of great use to our readers. Jacinta Burton, thank you so much.
Thanks, Matt.
And you can check this story out in the latest edition of the Business News magazine. And we'd encourage you to listen to the next episode of our daily podcast, At Close of Business, which you can hear tomorrow. Thanks for joining us today.
The latest business news, delivered daily. Subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to your podcasts. For all the latest business news, visit businessnews.com.au.